Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is The Exchange. If you've heard the NHPR podcast Bear Brook, you'll be familiar with that music. 3 years ago, NHPR's Jason Moon was assigned to cover a press conference dealing with the discovery of four bodies found in two barrels near Bear Brook State Park. The identity of the victims was a mystery, but using a variety of methods from isotope testing to genetic genealogy, the investigators have identified the killer and gotten closer to figuring out who those people were. This cold case changed the way murders are investigated anywhere and has raised ethical questions about the use of genetic genealogy in the search for elusive killers. In this hour, we're going to talk with Jason Moon about his reporting, and we want you to ask your questions or make comments as you see fit. The number to call is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. So, Jason, good morning. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And just a warning to our listeners who haven't heard the podcast or haven't heard the end of it yet that there's going to be spoilers in this hour. So do bear that in mind as you listen. So, Jason, I want to start the conversation at the beginning. So you learned about this, as we said, at a press conference years ago. You were assigned to that. What made you think this story was worth greater exploration in podcast form?
Well, you're right. I did find out about this story through a press conference, which is kind of, for a reporter, kind of the least remarkable way to stumble into a big story. But I was grabbed by the story for two reasons, really. One, just the basic facts of the case itself, where we have essentially an entire family who has been murdered and, sort of discarded in the woods in New Hampshire. And for 30 years, we haven't known who they are. And that is just one of those simple kind of, it raises that kind of simple question in you, which is just how could that happen? How could nobody have noticed this family was missing? How does something so awful like that happen? So that was one part of it. The other part was at that press conference in 2015, they were unveiling their results of this new forensic scientific testing that they had done on the remains, which was all about the science of isotopes. And I was frankly blown away once I kind of got my head around it, what they were able to tell about the victims simply based on the chemical composition of their remains. So, based on their diet, their drinking water that they were exposed to, certain environmental factors, they could tell with some level of specificity where they likely grew up, and then also details about their movements in the time before they died. And I remember just leaving that press conference thinking, like, wow, they can do that? It seems sort of unbelievably advanced to me. So I was sort of propelled by that, the horrible mystery at the center of it and this really kind of fascinating science that was being deployed to try to solve it. And then from there, I found lots of other reasons to be sort of fall deeper down that rabbit hole. But that was what initially grabbed me.
Mm-hmm. So tell us the basic details of this case. For those listeners who may not be familiar at all with what we're talking about here, tell us about the discovery of the bodies.
Yeah, so it starts in 1985. A hunter comes across an overturned barrel. It has the remains of two victims in it. It's an adult female, later estimated to be in her late 20s to early 30s, and a female child somewhere between, I believe, somewhere around 9 years old, give or take a few years on either side. That was the beginning of the case, and in some ways that was sort of the end of the case because we really never learned much more than that. It was two bodies found, just beyond the edge of Bear Brook State Park in Allenstown, New Hampshire, but there were no leads. Basically, there were no witnesses. There were no missing persons reports that matched. No one you know, from surrounding communities seem to remember anyone who could be the victims. And so the case sort of went, I mean, it went cold very quickly. And then nothing really happened until the year 2000 when a new detective picked up the case, state trooper by the name of John Cody. He was just in the beginning stages of familiarizing himself with the details of the case, decided that he needed to go out to the scene where the bodies were found to have a look for himself. And on his first trip out to the crime scene, made a really incredible discovery.
Yeah, we have a portion of that portion of the podcast for listeners to hear now. Let's hear John Cody, the detective on the State Police's Major Crimes Unit. He was looking at the location, and this is when he stumbled upon the second barrel.
A barrel was on its side next to a small boulder and some brush. Cody recognized it right away. He'd been looking at a barrel just like it in evidence storage a few days before. Dark blue, 55 gallons. Cody decided now was a good time to get the flashlight after all. He made his way back out to the edge of the woods, his mind racing the whole time.
You know, I think I was trying to talk myself out of it the whole way to the car, going, this is definitely not what I think it is.
When Cody returned with his flashlight, he shined it inside the barrel. And all he could see was some kind of plastic.
And I tore the plastic away, and there was something white that was shining towards me. You know, kind of sticks out with the dark background. When I looked at it, I said, this does not look good.
And that was one of the most stunning parts of this podcast that came early on, which is that, you know, 1985, you find one barrel, and then just, what was it, 300 yards away?
300 feet away,
there was a second barrel. And so the obvious question is, how did you miss this? But you tackle that question here. How was this missed?
Well, we try to. You know, I'm not sure there's ever a simple answer to that question. There are just different interpretations of answers to that question. I mean, you know, the answer the sort of the official line you'll get from investigators was, well, this was in a heavily wooded area. There was no reason to believe that you should extend the perimeter of the crime scene that far. And it was just, you know, hard to find, basically. There are some other factors, I think, that that went into it taking 15 years to find the second barrel. A big one was that on the same weekend that the first barrel was found, there was also another really high-profile murder in New Hampshire. A fellow by the name of Danny Paquette was shot in his yard. It also went on to become a sort of infamous cold case in New Hampshire. It also took decades to be solved. So the fact that the first barrel and this other cold case started in New Hampshire on the same weekend, I think, had a lot to do with the fact that the second barrel wasn't found. But, you know, we'll really never know how things might have gone differently. But I think those were some of the factors that sort of led into that.
Listeners, if you've got questions about Bear Brook Podcast or about genetic genealogy and how it was used to help identify the killer, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. So, okay, the two barrels were found. Police was on it. Police was on the case. Who else was on the case?
Well, because I think of the nature of the case, this deep mystery and this big twist of finding a second set of bodies in 2000, it attracted the attention of some folks outside law enforcement, some people who you might refer to as amateur investigators or citizen sleuths or web sleuths, people who have a real interest in trying to solve the case from a sort of outside law enforcement perspective. And one woman in particular who has spent many years working on the case, her name is Rhonda Randall. She'd be familiar to any of the detectives who've worked on the case. She has basically devoted the last several years of her life to working on the case and uncovering new details about it and talking to folks who lived in town who maybe had things to offer.
Mm-hmm. And we have a clip of Rhonda Randall speaking from episode 2 about how she came across the story of the unidentified bodies in Bear Brook.
One time I went to the New Hampshire State Library and I read the Concord 1984 phone book, every name, every page. It took me 14 hours, it took 2 days, and I was motion sick by the end of every day, like severely motion sick. I've been called, whether it's a compliment or not, I don't know, but you know, a pit bull, that kind of thing. You know, I tend to be tenacious. I sink my teeth in something and I don't let go.
And that tenacity is important in a case like this because there are so many little details to comb through, and she seemed willing to do that.
Yeah, yeah. It's a really interesting phenomenon. I've through the course of reporting this, I've met a number of people now who have a very similar story to Rhonda's, which is that they get invested in this case, they learn a little bit about it, and then they get really invested in it and spend hours and hours, like all day, you know, every weekend researching the case and trying to learn what they can. You know, at first I wasn't sure, you know, if that was a useful endeavor, but I have to say, I think after what we have learned and are still continuing to learn about the case, that there's a lot of reason to think that these folks are doing a valuable service and can and do find things that police haven't. So it's an interesting sort of, you know, juxtaposition against there was this high-tech science being used to try to solve the case, these isotopes, analysis that was so, it seemed so advanced to me. And on the other hand, you have this very sort of low-tech persistence and dogged research of amateurs. And that was another one of those things that kept me interested in the case and drove my reporting, was this sort of symmetry to it, that you had the high-tech analysis, low-tech shoe leather, all trying to solve the same mystery.
I want to ask you about the isotopes and the role they played in just a moment. But first, I want to get a comment from Steve in Nottingham. Steve, thanks very much for calling. You're on the air.
Good morning. First of all, I'm a reporter for a newspaper called The Forum, and I cover Nottingham. So I am just so thrilled to know that reporters can do something in this age when everything is corporate news, and that the ability to actually, as you say, the shoe leather, gumbo, whatever, your tenacity. But what I'm really impressed with is how little people, I'm new to New Hampshire, only 13 years, but how little people knew about this case in New Hampshire. And that to me is astonishing.
Well, Steve, thanks very much. And yeah, Jason, has this raised awareness of what's happened in New Hampshire among people who may even live very close to Bear Brook State Park?
Yeah, I certainly hope so. And Steve, I share your surprise that more people didn't know about this case because it is so horrible and fascinating, and you'd think it would have gotten more coverage. But I have to say, one thing I learned in reporting it, in looking back through the archives of previous coverage, was that it didn't get a lot, especially the discovery of the second barrel in 2000. There was not a lot of coverage of that, including NHPR in that assessment, to be totally fair. But yeah, that is one of the things I hope that the podcast will do, and I hope that it's done, is just bring more awareness to the story. It gets the composite images of the victims in front of more faces. Maybe it jogs some memory. Maybe it generates tips that would be a great thing, I think, in my opinion, if the podcast leads to that. If it doesn't do that, though, I think it raises awareness about the notion that folks can go missing, and I think it's easier. One thing I've learned is that it's easier for folks to go missing than I think we like to think. It's easier for a sister or a cousin or a more distant relative to sort of drift out of your life and you don't hear from them for a long time, and that's what happens. I think that's how you end up with these types of situations where we sort of learn about similar stories through the podcast, that someone just moves away and the family thinks that it's because they don't want to hear from them anymore, but really what's happened is a lot more awful than that.
Yeah. And so that may explain why a family member disappears and there's no official missing persons report, which is something police rely on.
Exactly.
All right. So about those isotopes and the isotopic testing, this is, you said, one of the things that really sparked your interest. How does the testing of isotopes, first of all, what are isotopes and how does the testing of them help investigators sort of narrow down the scope of their inquiry?
Yeah, so not to get too sciencey on you, but isotopes are, they're atoms. They're atoms with either too few or too many neutrons. If you think back to your high school chemistry class, neutrons are the other thing besides protons in the nucleus. They're not the electrons, they're the neutrons. And basically there are a subset of isotopes that can be referred to as environmental isotopes, and they're naturally occurring. They show up in different environments based on different sets of environmental factors. So areas that get more rainfall have more of a certain type of oxygen isotope, for example. And there's a set of maybe six or seven isotopes that have characteristics that can be geographically located. And meanwhile, humans, animals, all living things are absorbing these isotopes into our bodies through our diets, through the drinking water, through just general exposure to the environment. And so scientists, it's actually a technique that comes from geology. That's where it was sort of first used, to sort of track the history of rocks. But now it's been adapted to, first it was archaeology, so looking at sort of very old human remains and old artifacts. Now it's been, in the last, I would say, decade, it's been sort of adapted from that to cold cases where they can look at the remains of a human and look at the isotopes and say, this person was in an environment that got a lot of rainfall. They can look at things about their diet and make educated guesses about which country they lived in based on whether the diet was, like, you know, very wheat-based versus rice-based, you know, things like that.
One of the things the investigators found was that through testing the kind of lead isotopes in gasoline, you could determine, is this person from North America or are they from Europe? Now, it doesn't necessarily really narrow it down, but, you know, that's not an insignificant thing to figure out.
It's something. Yeah, you can narrow down from basically the entire globe to a country and maybe some regions within that country, so, and which is, it doesn't sound like a lot, but it's a lot when you're starting from basically scratch, which is what we had in the Bear Brook case. And so, yeah, the fact that lead isotopes could be used was really kind of blew my mind. And that's only useful because we used leaded gasoline for so many years across the globe. We were basically polluting the environment all over the world with lead. But the lead used in different gasolines from different countries used different lead isotopes. And so it's a sort of weird, almost silver lining to the decades of environmental pollution that leaded gasoline gave us, that we can now use that pollution to, you know, geolocate human remains. It's a fascinating and strange byproduct of all that.
There are a few ways to do it. I mean, in your teeth, for example, that's sort of solidified when you're a child, so you can figure out where those people were when they were children. And more recently, you can figure out, by using hair samples, where they were in the last, 3 weeks to 2 months of their lives?
Well, yeah, it depends on how long your hair is.
Okay, so it could be longer than that.
Yeah, it's sort of like a timeline of their most recent history, which is really fascinating to me. So every time you get a haircut, you're sort of cutting off your isotopic timeline, in a sense. It makes the act of getting a haircut a bit more profound.
So what did isotopic testing of the hair of these victims tell investigators about where they were shortly before they died?
Well, it gave a couple of clues, one of which was that they were likely in the area in New England in the weeks leading up to their death. And it also gave us a clue about the movement of different sets of the victims. So three of the victims are maternally related, but one of the children victims was not. And the isotopes from the hair suggest that the group came together a couple of months before they were murdered. So that is one of those clues that might turn out to be useful in terms of locating the identities of these victims, because now you're looking for a group of three victims who a few months before their death met up with the fourth victim, joined the group before they were killed. So that just gives some, you know, slight clues into the timeline.
So narrowing it down a little bit further, and Next up for investigators, using genetic genealogy to figure out exactly who these people were and who the killer may have been. We're going to talk about that after a short break, but we want to take your questions and hear your comments as well. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We'll talk about genetic genealogy and how it factored into the reporting of Bear Brook Podcast in just a minute. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
NHPR's Leadership Circle is a community of listeners who place a high value on intelligent and independent radio. I'm Sarah Alger, Director of Major Gifts at NHPR. As a Leadership Circle sustaining member, your $100 a month investment helps NHPR create and deliver the award-winning news you trust and the outstanding programs you love. If you've been looking to deepen your commitment to the station that's an essential part of your life and your community, join us at nhpr.org/leadershipcircle.
Coming up tomorrow on The Exchange on NHPR, aquaculture. We'll be speaking with our guests about new ways of producing our food. Is this the wave of the future? New ways of producing food? Send us a note by email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Right now, we're talking with NHPR's Jason Moon about the podcast Bear Brook and about how genetic genealogy has become a go-to method for uncovering the mysteries behind many cold cases across the country. Give us a call if you have questions or comments about this, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And also joining us in this part of the program is Buzz Scher. He's a law professor at the University of New Hampshire, and he's got some experience with using DNA in court. Buzz, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
So, listeners, again, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or email exchange@nhpr.org. So, DNA is a super important part for investigators, both professional and amateur, when it comes to figuring out the identity of the killer and possibly finding out who the people in the barrels were. But not all DNA is created equal. Jason, you reported on how autosomal DNA is a really important part of this. What is that? Why is that more significant than other parts of DNA?
Yeah, well, I guess the way to put it is not all DNA tests are created equal. And there's been a really interesting set of advances made in DNA testing over the last 10, 15 years that have come from outside of law enforcement. So the way I like to think about it is that for a long time, the law enforcement has been using DNA tests in a way that is very much like fingerprinting, where you have a fingerprint, it's unique to you, you can be used to match you to a trace you left behind. That's sort of the, if you think about the traditional way DNA has been used in criminal investigation, the sort of law and order DNA test where a suspect leaves a blood at a crime scene, it gets matched to them, that's their blood, bingo, right? Meanwhile, folks interested in genealogy have been sort of pushing the boundaries of what DNA tests can be capable of. And they, because they were interested in not just matching one-to-one, the way police were, they are interested in matching you to your family. They were looking for different kinds of DNA tests, and they developed one that relies on autosomal DNA, which is basically most of your DNA. It's all of your DNA except for your sex chromosomes, except for the X and Y. And they have developed a test which basically take a snapshot of your DNA and then can compare it to your relatives, will compare it to a database. And based on the amount of that DNA that you share with other folks in that database, they can guesstimate how closely you're related to them. And it's a really powerful technique because it means that you can identify hundreds or even thousands of relatives from a single source of DNA by testing it against the database. So instead of taking a sample and testing it, looking for one match, now genealogists take a sample, put it in the database, and find thousands of matches. Mm-hmm. The matches are just different relatives, different, so all from, you know, immediate family all the way up to like fifth cousins.
Huh. So how is a database like this assembled? Because, I mean, personally, I don't know if I've ever willingly given my DNA up to a database. Would I have done so unknowingly, or would I know if I'm doing it?
You would probably know, but, well, there's a few things to say there. The way these databases get constructed is, at the beginning, it was through, like, hardcore genealogist enthusiasts. So the Mormon Church was very interested in this, interestingly enough, and they were compiling their own DNA databases. And then commercial DNA databases began to be a thing. So think of 23andMe, Ancestry.com, where they could mail you a kit to your home. You spit in a little tube. You mail it back. It's really simple and easy to do. It's really inexpensive, only like $100 or less. And people were interested to learn about, you know, their ethnic background, where they may have come from, along with the sort of traditional genealogical questions: what's the family history, where did we immigrate from, that sort of stuff. And that's really where it sort of came to the masses, where people started to really send in their DNA en masse because it became a consumer product.
And Buzz Scher, when you hear something like that, genetic testing becoming available to the masses, what legal issues pop to your mind immediately?
Several. One, just a side note, the extreme version of these genetic databases is the country of Iceland, where unless you opt out, you as a citizen of Iceland are in the database. It's a countrywide law.
And what was the government's justification for setting that up?
Well, Iceland is an island country. Everybody in Iceland is related to everybody in Iceland, and they are the whole country's obsessed with genealogy. And finally, because they're related, that kind of comprehensive database provides a wonderful tool for genetic research. And the country decided through their legislature to impose this law where everybody contributes, and it's tied to your medical records. Hmm. And there's an opt-out provision. So that's the extreme version of these genealogical databases.
Anyway, we're talking about the issues that came to your mind.
So the fundamental question, two fundamental questions. One, do you know what your DNA is in for when you submit it to be it 23andMe or one of these genealogical databases? Early on, what you are made aware of when you send in your sample was very, very generalized. It's one of those fine print, lengthy things that one out of every 1,000 people reads. And that when you read it, you don't send it in. But it really gives them this blanket permission to do whatever. And they were not that much more specific than that. So the question becomes, really, did I sign up for you to give my DNA to the police? Is, you know, in this circumstance, that question. The other question is it fair, is it ethical, is it moral for you to give your DNA up when it tells you something not only about yourself, but about people to whom you're related? About your brother, your mother, your father, your children. And that's a really tough one. If Peter, you know, you want to give your DNA up to one of these databases and you're aware of what you're in for, and your father says, no, I don't want you to send in that because it tells them about me too, what's the right thing to do in that circumstance?
That's a thorny question. Jason, in your reporting here, I mean, there were times where the police asked some of the people who might be helpful in this investigation to provide a DNA sample. Did they get any pushback from that? And was it because of the concerns that Buzz just listed?
Yeah, they did meet some resistance for a number of reasons. I think one was likely what Buzz was just describing. Another was the detectives were in this difficult situation where they were having to essentially cold call people and ask them for their DNA, which just imagine if you're sitting at home and someone, you know, calls you and asks for
that
your
would be
DNA.
A tough sell,
yeah.
I have to say.
So they had to do a lot of work to convince some folks and have them, you know, verify through their local police departments that they were, in fact, detectives working on a case. But, yeah, Buzz is certainly right. It does raise a lot of questions at a lot of different a lot of different levels. It's not just you. It is information about your extended family, which is the really fascinating thing about genetic information, what makes it so powerful and also what makes it so thorny.
Let me just follow up on that briefly. And there's this other piece of this that when the police ask for your DNA, like, we want your house was burglarized. We want to get your DNA to eliminate the source of the sample found in your house. Well, in some jurisdictions, particularly in Florida and California, the police ask for that specific purpose, and then they hold on to it.
Hmm.
And there's that it's not regulated what else they can do with it. So there's what these called these – the police in some jurisdictions are creating these rogue databases.
Listeners, if you'd like to weigh in on this, if you have submitted your DNA to one of these commercial sites, how do you feel about it now that you've heard what Buzz just said? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Or maybe you've just heard what Buzz said and you don't care and you still want to do it because you want to know more about your heritage and possible other family members out there. The number is 1-800-892-6477, or you can email exchange@nhpr.org. We got a question emailed from Michael. Are there any legal or ethical considerations when law enforcement personnel use DNA databases to identify suspects? That seems to be particularly aiming at law enforcement. And Michael continues, seems to me that most people don't object to this, but would probably bristle at the thought of a national database of fingerprints compiled without your knowledge or consent. Thanks very much for your questions, Michael. Buzz, seems like you want to weigh in.
Yeah, there's several layers to that. The way police most commonly use your DNA, the DNA of the biological sample of unknown origin, is they run it through what are called statutory genetic databases. Every state has one, New Hampshire has one, and the federal government has one. And they run it through there to see if the unknown sample's genetic profile matches anyone in there. And that's kind of a cold hit circumstance is what they call it. But there's another layer to it that's developed over the past 5 to 10 years called familial searching, which is, in a sense, predated genetic genealogy, where they'll send the sample, the profile, through the database. It doesn't hit at all 13 locations, so the one it hits on is not the suspect. The one it hits on matches at 6 or maybe 7 locations, which means we know that the owner of that profile in the database is related to the person who left that sample at the crime scene. So then they go and investigate the family of the person who is in that database and to find out if there's anyone who might have been around. And it's a very controversial technique. Some states have banned it and others have encouraged it. So that's the most common way it's used. And it makes people nervous. I sometimes say the moral of that story is be careful to whom you are related.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones. If you have a question or comment, give us a call now. We'd love to bring you into the conversation. The number is 1-800-892-6477. And let's talk to Jennifer in Hanover. Jennifer, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I just wanted to make a comment and sort of a point of clarification as someone who works in genetic genealogy. I think listeners might be under the impression that if they test with one of the commercial companies, that those companies are allowing law enforcement to access their data. And to my knowledge, that is actually not the case. But if you test with one of those companies and choose to download your raw data, which you own, that's your choice, you can then upload it to what is more of a public sort of crowdsourced database called GEDmatch. And that is where law enforcement has been using this information to identify Jane and John Doe's and to work on some of these cold cases. So Ancestry is not passing on your data to law enforcement. You would have to download your data and upload it to this database before it could be used and accessed that way. And GEDmatch makes that very clear. They've made some changes in their terms of service so that people who do upload to that service understand that potential use of their data.
Jennifer, thank you. Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, Jason does report on this in Bear Brook that you do write, Jason, that Ancestry.com, 23andMe.com, pretty much off limits, is what you said, to law enforcement. Why? Why can't law enforcement go directly to those sites?
Yeah, so everything that the caller just said is absolutely correct. In terms of law enforcement using genetic genealogy to identify suspects, it is not happening through the big commercial databases. The reason is, to get a sample into those databases, you actually have to send them your spit. So you can't actually, a police department can't take their sample and enter it in without the company wanting to accept it. And they don't want to do that because they're afraid of losing customers. They see it as a privacy issue. And some of them use pretty strong language in saying they will resist to the fullest extent they can any attempt by law enforcement to access their database. So what's been happening is there's this other website called GEDmatch, which the caller mentioned, which is a sort of almost like a Wikipedia for genetic genealogy, where folks can download the data from their DNA test that they took at a company like Ancestry or 23andMe, and then they upload the data to this website, which allows for more open sharing, and it does allow people to upload data from different sources. So police sort of understand that they can upload the data from their DNA samples into GEDmatch, mm-hmm. where the rules are a bit looser, and find people. And that has become basically the de facto police genetic genealogy database. That was the database that identified the killer in the Bear Brook murders. It was the database that identified the suspected Golden State killer. And it's the database that has been used in upwards of a dozen cases already since that, to lead to arrests and charges being filed. That is the epicenter where this activity is happening in the criminal side.
But sure.
And there's some concerns with GEDmatch. GEDmatch, certainly, I think when the Bear Brook case was playing out and some other cases were playing out, we're not telling the people who are uploading their genetic profile. By the way, if the police, it may be that the police ask us and we provide them with access. They weren't telling them that, be aware that the police could be surreptitiously running samples through the database. They were completely quiet about all those possibilities. They have since then improved that notice. I still don't think it's an adequate notice, but
well, the notice, right, says that it could be used for other purposes,
right?
Like
yeah.
Like a super broad, super vague thing.
And less people will send their DNA in if they know that the police will have access to it. And I think, you know, I understand that concern on their part, but there's a very significant lack of notice. And that has been – that lack of notice and what you're going to use my DNA for has been an issue in medical ethics and genetic research for, you know, 25 years. So mm-hmm. This is not a new issue. It's playing out in a different context. But I think GEDmatch is a fascinating example of science being really cool and science being at least emotionally provocative and maybe dangerous too.
Yeah. Bill wrote in with a question, a couple of questions actually. First question, a comment on your guest comment about a father not wanting his child to submit DNA. Bill says, isn't my DNA my DNA? Like, my car is my car and I can sell or give it away if I want. Buzz, what do you think?
No and yes. Your DNA as a whole is unique to you, but 99.9% of your DNA is the same as my DNA, as Peter's DNA, as Jason's DNA. So don't get all cranked up about the uniqueness of your DNA.
Okay.
Number one. Number two, ownership, you can't patent your DNA. That's a form of ownership. And the U.S. Supreme Court has said you can't patent a gene sequence because it exists in nature. So you can't have that kind of ownership. But there's a few states out there that characterize your genetic information as private. And you have a property interest in it, but the huge majority of states do not take that position.
Bill continues, if Dad didn't want me to share my DNA, I would begin wondering what Dad had been up to, and I'd share anyway. Bill continues, I have done 23andMe. You've got some shocked expressions in this room here, Bill. Bill says, I have done 23andMe. and found nothing that would embarrass Dad, but found all sorts of second, third, and fourth cousins. So that's the
here's,
kind of
here's what happens, and here's what embarrasses Dad. You both send them in, and you, what you find out is, I am not Dad's son, genetic son. My father is somebody else, and that has happened. A very close friend of my son-in-law, that's exactly what happened. He didn't know that he was not his father's son, and he was 35, 36 years old, and that has really torn apart that family. So it's in many ways humorous about what Dad wants and doesn't want, but there's some really, really difficult moral and emotional problems that develop. You know, a couple going to a genetic counselor for DNA testing, and they get tested, and their first child gets tested. They're concerned about the genetic disorder their second child might have, and it turns out the first child is not the child of the father. And what does the genetic counselor do in that circumstance? Mm. What does genetic counselor say to those people? So these problems are immense, unintended, and really perplexing.
Jason, your thoughts?
Yeah, there are so many scenarios that you can imagine where you learn things that you didn't know you were going to learn. And that is part of what makes genetic genealogy and genetic information in general so powerful and so thorny, because especially with the commercial databases, they're looking for as much information as they can. So they're looking for not only your ethnic background, but also health information about you. They're sort of figuring out new ways all the time of getting more information out of your DNA. And the things you learn might not always be what you wanted to learn.
Yeah.
I as a part of reporting this story, I actually did send my DNA into 23andMe. And there are some interesting language in the notices, because I was reading them because I was reporting on this. And one of them says something to the effect of, some of the knowledge you may gain from this DNA test, it could be profound and life-changing, and you can't unlearn things, basically.
Yeah. Did you, before you did this test, consult with your family? Or did it occur to you to consult with your family?
It did occur to me, and I did not.
Okay. Why not?
Well, because I wanted to... First of all, I wanted to see if I would have matches, because I was speaking with a genetic genealogist who assured me that right now I would have thousands of matches in the database. And the reason I wanted to do the test was to see if that was right. And if it was right, then my family had already made that decision, in a sense, because thousands of cousins of mine had already decided to put their DNA in 23andMe. And so I was already exposed, in a sense, if you want to think of it that way. And that is the back to that issue of, is it my DNA or my family's DNA? Is it mine or is it all of ours?
And one of the really provocative pieces of this all, thinking about it at another level, is, you know, how much of our identity is wrapped up in our biology, the biology of our body, of our genetic heritage? How much, you know, if it turns out my father is not actually my genetic father, my biological father, but he's been my father for 60 years, you know, what does it mean to be a father? You know, how much does it matter that he's not my genetic father? These kind of cases are just all over the place, and they really make you try and figure out what about my identity is wrapped up in my genetic ancestry or my genetic parentage?
Listeners, we're talking with NHPR's Jason Moon and Buzz Scher of UNH about Bear Brook podcast, about genetic genealogy, its uses when it comes to cold cases and identifying both the victims and the perpetrators behind long unsolved murders. We're also going to talk in the next part of the program a little bit with Jason about how he reported about the music behind the program. If you have questions for Jason or for Buzz, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Lots more to come. This is The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. The This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we're talking with NHPR's Jason Moon about the podcast Bear Brook and how the discovery of four bodies in barrels near Bear Brook State Park in New Hampshire has puzzled investigators who have been using genetic genealogy to figure out who those people were. Also with me for this part of the show is Buzz Scher, law professor at the University of New Hampshire. Listeners of the podcast will note that Buzz appears in episode 6 of the podcast, where he talks about the legal and ethical issues of police use in genetic genealogy to solve these cases. Listeners, give us a call if you have questions or comments about this. 1-800-892-6477. You can email exchange at nhpr.org. Billy in Boscawen emailed us to say, my older sister submitted her DNA to one of the ancestry.com-like services. They came back with results basically saying she descended from Europeans. But now realizing that she didn't just submit her individual DNA, but essentially mine too, makes me glad she's going out of town for Thanksgiving. And I have to wonder, that's Billy and Bosco, and Billy continues, I have to wonder what the real motive of these DNA testing companies really is. So, Buzz, are these companies in existence to make money, or is there something else behind it? What is it?
They're in existence to make money. They actually don't make the money. I mean, they make money off the $99 you pay to get your DNA done, so to speak. But where they make the big money is they sell your genetic profile, your DNA, to medical research companies. And that's where they make the big money. So this is there's a definite profit motive here. Not that it's not useful and interesting and entertaining to find out what your genetic ancestry is, but the big money is in medical research. And they say they anonymize that which they give to these companies.
They disclose that when you sign up to say, yes, we do this, but we take your name off it?
Yeah, to some extent. You know, I'm never really satisfied with the specificity of what they disclose they're going to do with it. And, you know, they're only disclosing what they think they can do with it now. But 5 years from now, somebody else may say, hey, if you sell us this information, we can do something with this DNA that nobody's ever thought of before. You didn't agree to that when you submitted your DNA. So there's that kind of longitudinal problem.
Is that why they leave the terms of service broad, so to speak, so that they can change it later?
And again, as I said before, this debate has been going on in the medical research community at National Institutes of Health and among bioethicists for 25 years. What do you do with, hey, I got this DNA from this person 5 years ago for this research project, and now I got a new idea. I'm going to use this. Do I have to go back and ask them? And it gets very complicated.
Is there a particular part of the Constitution that prohibits law enforcement from sort of demanding your DNA?
Such an interesting question.
We only have a few minutes here.
I'll be done in about 4 hours. the federal Constitution, there's the Fourth Amendment, which prevents unreasonable searches and seizures. If I were to follow you around, I, an undercover cop, were to follow you around and take your DNA off the coffee cup you left at Starbucks, they can do that. The Constitution has been interpreted by courts to say that doesn't count as a search. Interestingly, last Tuesday in New Hampshire, the voters passed Part 1, Article 2B of the New Hampshire Constitution, which guarantees one can live free from the government interfering in your personal and private information. That is a specific information privacy constitutional amendment. That's going to change the way courts in New Hampshire think about genetic privacy, and particularly the privacy of your genetic information. I'm very familiar with this since I worked with Representative Neil Kirk in writing that amendment.
Mm-hmm. So Jason, overall, has it been sort of a combination of efforts on the part of police and volunteer genealogists to actually untangle this? Because it's a complicated web involving not just the murders here in New Hampshire, but also a murder in California, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, it's an incredibly complicated story in case it took, you know, 6 episodes for us to sort of untangle it all. But yes, it was the work of genealogists primarily that led us to where we are today. And just to, you know, to bring us back to what started the conversation, and to remind listeners of the immense promise of this technique, that genetic genealogy is now being used to solve some of the most notorious and heinous crimes of, you know, some that are decades old, you know, the Golden State Killer, if he's convicted, that will mean that someone who has, you know, committed dozens and dozens of murders and rapes and burglaries have been brought to justice. So just to, you know, this is like the hot ticket right now in terms of forensic science in criminal investigations. Genealogists who know how to do this, who are skilled at this work, their phones are ringing off the hook right now in terms of, can you look at this case? Can you look at this case? And so that is sort of the leading edge of the conversation right now. But there's a lot of the other aspects, angles to that conversation that we're going to have to sort of sort out in the years to come.
Well, Jason, let me spend a few minutes asking you about the way you went about reporting and writing this, because for public radio news purposes, there's, you know, the short news spot that comes out of a press conference like the one you initially went to 3 years ago. And those are very just the facts, ma'am, kind of reporting, yeah. Right? You know, the who, what, when, what we know, what we don't. It's not a first person narrative. And then this podcast, it's basically hours and hours of well-researched first person narrative where you fill in personal details. You get in the heads of these real human beings, not just names and titles and things that they said or did at a press conference. Talk to us a little bit about the difference between reporting those two types of things.
Well, there are differences that I've kind of had to learn along the way. It is certainly a different type of storytelling than what we normally do on air here, but something we thought was worth taking a risk on because, frankly, there was just so much to this story that we didn't feel like we could fit it in the normal length. You know, a normal news feature we do here is maybe 4, 5, 6 minutes, and in fact, I tried at first to write. There's a draft of a 6-minute version of the podcast somewhere on my computer, but we just decided that there was too much going on. There was too much science to explain, and really important science we thought to get across, especially the genetic genealogy stuff. I think this is going to be, you know, an education for a lot of listeners about. I mean, it was for me in reporting it for a really important topic that I think we're going to be debating for a long time. So for reasons like that, for reasons like. The case was just so complicated. There was two cases in California that connected and another one in New Hampshire. We felt like we weren't doing it justice to do it in a sort of traditional way. And so we, you know, made the effort to try to do something bigger. And, you know, I think it was the right one. I hope listeners feel the same way.
It's certainly been well reviewed, and kudos to you and the team for putting this together. In stories like this, like true crime stories, one of the criticisms you hear from people is that the reporter is spending way too much time talking about the perpetrator, the person who did this, too much time exploring his or her life or character, and that in some ways lends them a sort of shine, glorifies them.
Yeah.
I don't personally think that you did this here, but I'm curious if this idea was on your mind as you were writing this script.
Very much so. Very much so. And in fact, I would say that I am the type of person who would espouse that criticism of other true crime media that I am aware of. And in fact, you know, just personally, I'm not particularly driven to the genre. But I felt like this was I got caught in this story that I felt was really compelling. And I thought it was really worth reporting out. And we did think a lot, I think, about how we were portraying particularly the victims, trying to find whatever ways we could to remind listeners that these were real three-dimensional human beings, you know, which is a challenge in a case like this where the victims were unidentified. We don't know almost anything about them other than their, you know, genders and ages. Doing what we can to just remind people that this was a real thing, that this is a real crime, there are real victims here, and using that to sort of you know underscore the idea of like, why is the science so important? It's because it has real impacts on real cases like this. And so, yeah, I'm not sure if we totally achieved that goal, but that was certainly on our mind, to not sensationalize the story, not to to be respectful about it.
Mm-hmm. How important for you or for the narrative in your mind was the fact that some of the people in this were just, they were interesting people, and they had quirks of speech, and just, they were also very good storytellers. I'm thinking particularly of Roxanne Grunheid, mm-hmm. who for whom every sketchy thing was goofy, right? Which was a great tick of her speech to include. How important was that for you, that the people that you spoke to and the people that were featured here were interesting in and of themselves?
Yeah, there are, certainly were some great characters, I have to say, that I've met along the way. What was interesting to me is that they were all interesting characters insofar as they were gripped by the case in a way that they really didn't have control over. And that was a sort of interesting theme across all different types of characters in the story. You know, Ron Montplaisir, the Allenstown officer who came across the first barrel, he was sort of haunted by by the fact that it hadn't been solved. And Rhonda Randall, the amateur investigator who just couldn't seem to let it go because of the injustice of it. And for Roxanne Grunheid, the detective from Contra Costa County out in California, similarly, just a real need to see this thing through, even when she didn't really have to. It was sort of her case was finished, and she kept working on this anyways. You know, I don't know how. I think a lot of what makes those characters interesting as real people is the fact that they were so invested in the case. You know, I'm not sure it would have come across without that.
Yeah, and final thing I want to ask you, Jason, is, wow, you composed some of the music for this. Some of it was found online, but also you wrote it.
Yeah.
So you're a musician in your spare time.
In my spare
your second
time,
life.
That's a good way to put it, yeah. Yes, it was something we didn't necessarily plan at the beginning of this, but trying to put this together, I decided it would be quicker and easier in a sense that I'd have more control over certain aspects of the music to try to take a stab at it myself. And I didn't really expect that we'd keep it. I thought it was sort of a placeholder, but yeah, here we are.
Well, so. Jason Moon, thank you very much for being here and also for your stellar reporting on Bear Brook, which you can find at bearbrookpodcast.org.
Thanks, Peter.
And also thanks to Buzz Scher, law professor at the University of New Hampshire, for being here today.
My pleasure.
Listeners, again, check out Bear Brook Podcast at bearbrookpodcast.com or .org. It'll get you to the same place, and you can subscribe to it on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcast. And the conversation about this, of course, continues online at NHPR Exchange and at NHPR.org. The engineer today is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord and, at the beginning of the show, by Jason Moon. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Peter Biello, filling in for Laura Kanoi. Thank you very much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.